This is the final installment in the Moon is an Orange Triangle trilogy, a series which looks at families who live positively with autism. The first series looked at children, the second, teenagers, and this is part one of a three-part series which looks at adults. The Moon is an Orange Triangle, Series 3, Episode 2. Directed by Alison Toomey.
My name is Lara Smith. I am 20 years old and I am on the autistic spectrum. I am going to talk very briefly about three things: independent living and why it's important to me, some of the challenges I face, and my hopes for the future. One day in the not too distant future, I hope and am planning to live completely independently. I want to have a career using my many talents, have a great social life, and be a part of society generally, just like everybody else. The biggest fear for my parents is that they won't always be there for me. It is really important to me that I help ease their worries about this. My own personal biggest challenge towards achieving this goal is the serious anxiety levels I experience every day of my life. Even while talking to you now, although I may appear confident and relaxed and love what I am doing, inside my heart is beating so fast I feel like it could burst. My head feels like it could explode, and I am feeling more and more tense by the moment. This is a normal day-to-day experience for me, so don't feel too bad about it. It's an Aspie thing. All joking apart, though, this can make life very difficult for me, even with the most basic things like humour, health issues, public transport, busy shopping centres. Don't even talk to me about downward escalators. I could tell you a story or two about them, but time is of the essence today. I also struggle with organisational skills and time management, which causes no end of stress. And then, hello again, my good old friend, anxiety. Another little issue I struggle with, although I have to say it's not so much me as everybody else, is my tendency to say exactly what I think. Yeah, I know. Some people do not appreciate my direct honesty. But this is a work in progress for me, and I have learned to think before I speak. Causes less upset and embarrassment, obviously. But what's so wrong with a little honesty in this world? So, looking to the future, even though I have all this anxiety and other stuff going on, I plan to manage these problems as best as I can so I can fulfill my potential, enjoy myself, and live life to the full. But it's not all down to me. Society in general needs to be more understanding, adaptable, and inclusive of people with autism. We need to be recognised for the enormous positives we can contribute, particularly in the workplace, rather than in the negative way we are perceived now. That is why I'm so happy to be involved with As I Am. I really think it's going to change things for all of us. And these are very exciting times, and I am so lucky to be a part of it. That's all from me. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the rest of the day.
In this series, I spent time with three main characters. Later in the programme, you will get to meet John and Norma Finn and their severely autistic son, Martin. And I travelled to Cork to spend time with Stuart Nielsen, who was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome in 2009 at the age of 45. But first, a story about an incredible young man with Asperger's called Adam Harris, who founded the organisation As I Am. And here is Dr. Peter Vermeulen, one of the guest speakers at their very first conference.
Once you have autism, you can never be sad anymore. Because if you're sad, suddenly there's a crisis meeting of the staff members and there's goals and maybe he needs psychoeducation, huh? Maybe he needs psychotherapy. We are all entitled to our moments of feeling bad, aren't we? So happiness is not a kind of an orgastic state 24 hours a day. Huh? It's the balance between moments that you feel well and moments that go a little bit less well. But at least there should be a balance. Now, the moment you have more negative feelings, then of course you have little life satisfaction. And if it gets very out of balance, then we say people are very unhappy. And we all have our moments that we are very unhappy, that's okay, but it shouldn't last for too long time. Because if that stays for too long time, then we do know that people start to develop mental health issues, such and the most well-known are stress, anxiety, and depression. I think happy is more than the absence of negative things. We should focus on more positive things than negative things. And why would we do that? Well, first of all, I think it's all about the balance. You know what the balance is? The balance is 3-1. We need 3 positive moments to counter 1 negative one. We focus at 3 positive moments to counter 1 meltdown or 1 anxiety moment. What if we could make sure that there is an overdose on positive feelings? This means increasing the resilience of people with autism. I think you all know the term vicious circle. There's also a thing called virtuous circle. And especially when it comes to well-being, if you start triggering positive emotions in people, then it kind of creates a virtuous circle, which is the opposite of a vicious circle, going from bad to worse. It goes from good to better to even better. So there is a link between well-being, feeling well, and cognitive functioning. So we should find out what makes people happy. Now, what makes people happy? Well, I'm going to give an example that makes things quite clear. There's a couple of mistakes we can make. One is trying, as a neurotypical person, trying to put your ideas of happiness onto people with autism. There was this boy who was always standing in the corner of a playground, and then the teacher said, oh, he must be very lonely. Let's make him a social story for joining in with the kids. So they made this nice social story. They gave it to him and said, that's nice, but I won't do that. I said, why? Maybe you will have more fun when you can play together with the other children. He said, no. I like to watch other children play, but I don't want to join. Moreover, if I'm in the corner, suddenly there's no people who can suddenly come on my back and touch me. So I feel perfectly well here. You know, this is a neurotypical projection. When it comes to well-being, we now have a kind of a supermarket. And when people with autism or other people don't feel well, suddenly we come up with a whole bunch of strategies like, okay, let's do some cognitive behavioral therapy, some meditation, neurofeedback. You can staple up more and more of these strategies, but if there's no sound foundation, it will collapse. And the sound foundation is autism friendliness. And what is autism friendliness? I have my own definition for that, because it's a very posh word nowadays. Everybody has to be autism friendly. Now, if you look again at the definition of emotional well-being, there's different aspects, but 2 aspects are very central. That's clarity, predictability. So if you want to be autism friendly, we define it as 90% clarity and predictability and 10% normal friendliness. You know, for Autism Awareness Day 2 weeks ago, we asked 35 people with autism, who in your environment do you consider to be autism friendly to you? And they could name my sister, my father, my teacher, my counselor. Now we ask them, but what do they do that you think they are autism friendly? And in most cases, it's again in Dutch, sorry, here it says, my sister, because she always tells me in advance when she's coming to visit me, and she also tells me how long she's going to stay. Predictability, keyword. So if you want to be autism friendly, give them clarity and predictability first. All the rest comes later. There's 2 ladies that I admire, Ross Blackburn and Temple Grandin, who also said autism is never an alibi. Nowadays, in the Netherlands, you can get OT pass, and when you go to Disneyland Paris, you don't have to wait anymore. You don't have to queue. You can go in through the back door. I don't like that for 2 reasons. One is that it says, well, it says we don't think that people with autism have abilities to learn to wait, which is kind of discriminating, which is not believing in their strengths. Second thing is having difficulties with waiting. They are there, but don't we all hate to wait? Now, nowadays, with the increase in the number of diagnoses, in a couple of years, when I go with my grandchildren to Disneyland Paris, the queue on the autism entrance will be longer than... What I'm trying to say here is, don't avoid challenges. That's what Ross Blackburn said. I need high expectations. It's not because I have autism that you suddenly have to say, oh, poor thing, you don't have to wait anymore. No, expect me to wait, but support me so I have success in doing the things you expect from me. Because if we don't do that,
we create, and psychologists will know what I'm talking about, we create something called learned helplessness. We make people with autism more vulnerable. I do believe, and today is all about empowering, I do believe that people with autism have the power to cope with difficult situations. We only have to teach them to cope and to believe in their abilities. That's an empowering approach, isn't it? And we should not forget, happiness is not the absence of problems, it's the ability to deal with them.
What I do is spread knowledge about autism.
Okay.
I was kind of in a shock the moment I discovered that after 70 years of research in autism, there wasn't a single article on autism and happiness.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's terrible.
Isn't that appalling?
Yeah.
And I thought, why didn't anyone think about that? I'm not that smart.
Yeah.
And I think
that's quite sad, isn't it?
It is sad. Mm. While it's a basic need for every human being, we all want to be happy, why didn't anyone think about what can we do to make people with autism happy?
Mm.
You know, it's remarkable. Scientists developed questionnaires to measure anxiety in people with autism, to measure stress, to measure depression in people with autism. And there's no whatsoever measure for measuring well-being and happiness. I'm the first one, and I'm very proud to have developed an autism good feeling questionnaire.
Wow. Give me a sample of some of the questions. Give us an idea.
Well, some of the ideas is, for instance, when it comes to sensory environment, we tend to ask them, what in the sensory environment is bothering you? I do the opposite and say, what kind of sounds do you like? What kind of smell do you like? What kind of textures do you like? What's your favorite food?
You're flipping the whole thing, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. Turning it upside down.
It's great.
Because that's as informative as asking them what is bothering them. We need to know what is bothering them, obviously, but that's, again, only half of the story. It's the negative part of the story. What about the positive part of the story? For instance, there's so many people with autism in group homes, and they are taking a bath or a shower every day. I always ask professionals, have you ever wondered what his favorite smell is for a shampoo?
Mm.
They don't know. They don't know.
Sponges, textures.
They don't know. Said, come on, find out. Shouldn't be that difficult. Give it. He's nonverbal. Okay, then give it a try with different smells, eucalyptus or fruity or whatever, and see how he reacts. And if he takes it back, that means, and he sniffs it, that means he likes it. Okay, use that shampoo. It's those little, because happiness is not a big project. It's 1,000 little projects.
And isn't it very easy to see when someone's happy too? It's quite an easy thing to measure.
Of course.
When I last spoke with John and Norma Finn in Manchester, they told me they were going to bring Martin over to Ireland to attend a country and western festival in Gort, County Galway. So I arranged to meet them there in the hope that I might get to spend some time with Martin himself and with a bit of luck get to hear him sing. Norma, hi. Welcome to Ireland.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's very nice to be here.
Yeah. Do you like coming here?
Oh, we do, yeah.
Do you?
A little bit, yeah.
You come quite often. Do you? Well, at least once a year, yeah?
Well, we normally come around Easter and maybe either August or, yeah, about around August.
So maybe even twice a year?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you come over, always fly?
No, not normally. We used to come on the boat, but he likes flying, Martin.
Does he?
Yeah.
He's taken to the planes now.
Yeah, he likes.
So he likes flying.
The flying.
So we're here in the Lady Gregory in Gort. Tell me why you're over here.
Well, we've come over here just for the music, really. A music weekend it is. And there's all different singers on, different bands on.
Yeah.
Each night. And that's the kind of thing that Martin likes.
Yeah, so you come over here especially for the music.
We come over.
It's all for Martin, big trip for Martin.
Yes, yeah.
Do you guys enjoy it though?
Oh, we do, yeah.
That's just as well.
We love music.
Yeah. So you came down to have your breakfast on your own. So Martin and John are up in the bedroom at the moment.
Yeah, well,
why is that? What's that plan?
Well, sometimes Martin, if we're away somewhere, he won't go down in the mornings for his breakfast. So what we do, we go down separate and we bring Martin's back. John perhaps might go first, bring Martin some breakfast back for when he wakes up. and then sorts him out, and I go down then.
Right.
Because it, you know, it's we have to work it like that. Yeah.
Yeah. But as you said, he's upstairs chilling in the bedroom at the moment.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's, I'd say now he's looking forward to this afternoon's music.
Mm. So how does he adjust to staying in a hotel room for the few days? How does all that work out? What's the routine there?
Well, as I say again, if there's music on, he'll try and adjust. He will adjust to it,
mm-hmm.
because he's looking forward to to the music, so he will kind of adjust. Sometimes he could go in somewhere, and he might not want to. He might not want to stay if there's no music on or nothing that he's interested in. He won't want to stay.
Really? And so, what about the routine? I mean, I presume you have to lock the door at night, and you can't leave him on his own ever.
Oh no, you can't leave him on his own. Never, no.
You can't leave him in the bathroom on his own.
Oh no.
There's always one of you guys with him.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Always.
Yeah, he's 24-hour care, really.
Yeah.
And he sees no danger.
Right, none at all.
Not really, no. If he went out,
he's always been like that, yeah.
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 If you went out now, you'd have to keep hold of his hand. If you're walking with him, you couldn't let him walk by the side of you, because he could walk out in the road and he wouldn't see. He wouldn't understand now that he's not to go in the road and there's cars coming. And
so he would never stop and think to look left or right, ever?
No, never. Really, he needs washing, dressing. Yeah, he needs everything doing really for him. He needs a lot of help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think he always will do, really.
Mm.
And if you ask him his name, you just say, "What's your name? Tell this lady what your name is, or what is your name?" He'll say yes. So he doesn't really say, "Well, my name's Martin," or you know, he's.
I know John described it. He said that Martin's living in a very complicated world.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
It is complicated,
isn't it? It is complicated, yeah.
For him.
Yeah.
We can only imagine how complicated it is for
That's
you
it, yeah. You'd
trying
need
to understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. You'd need to be a mind reader sometimes to be able to fathom out what's, you know, what's wrong. Or
where does he get his release from? Do you have is there a technique? Is there something he does?
Well, I think it's the music.
Must be just the music, yeah.
I think the minute he's...
Because you can see him chilling.
Yes, yes, and he's quite happy with himself. You know, he does love music. Yeah. I think it's his life, really.
Like last time, Martin was reluctant to come downstairs knowing I was there, so Norma headed back up to the room so that John could join me for a quick chat.
It's a big night tonight, John.
Big night tonight,
it's a big night, yeah. Music
every night and
every day.
And every day. And Robert Mazzell is one of his favourites.
Go all over the place with him, don't you?
We take him to Spain. There's a hotel where they just more or less cater for all their own. It's nearly all Spanish people. And they don't speak no English. And we started going in there now for a few years. And there's a live music, and there's a lady plays a piano accordion. And she will ask Martin to sing, you know, and she will tell all the audience. It's packed with their own Spanish people. She will explain about Martin and his autism. And she will get Martin to hear, and he will sing to the live music, Spanish music. In Spanish.
So how does he do that?
He's familiar with the songs.
So he's learned. It's not that he's learned. Does he mimic them?
This is it, because he would try to sing it as close as possible to the original.
Mm.
So I suppose in theory he's copying the original. Trying to get it as close as possible.
But singing in a different language.
Well, it takes some. I mean, even just recently now, I tried him. I had him singing a little bit of a Gaelic song.
No way.
And, you'd think he was singing it all his life. So, the margin, I suppose, between his disability and his ability is unreal.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of... You know, when you said...
It doesn't make sense, really,
in the real world. If somebody's struggling with a bit of toast, and I get they could sing in Spanish and different languages.
And get up on stage?
Yeah.
In a packed room, with straight on all the sensory issues going on there, with all the noise and the movement. And you're smiling and laughing. You're obviously very proud of the fact that he can do that, yeah.
Like, you know, it's a marvellous achievement, and of course he needs a lot of help and a lot of support, but it's a lot of pleasure for us, like, to see you. I mean, if somebody was to come to me when Martin was 10 or 12 and say one day he'd be able to go up on stage, I would think,
how's that
miracles
happen?
They're far and few between, you know, which is true, like.
So he's your wee miracle, isn't
he? You know, I mean, he's one of me, no doubt about it, like. If you could rate his disability and his abilities, it's unreal.
I had spent so long talking to John and Norma about Martin's extraordinary ability to sing, even though he doesn't really talk. But up until now, I had only been in Martin's company for very short periods of time, and I had only ever heard him sing to himself. So I decided to join the family for a bite of food in Supermax to see if I could get closer to Martin and see if he'd start feeling more comfortable around me.
Sorry, go on.
Where'll I sit, John? You just tell me now.
Yeah. You can sit wherever you like now. I'll just move your bit on your ear.
Am I okay sitting beside Martin? Will he mind?
Yeah, he won't mind. Norma, can you just take a few things off the floor? Mm-hmm. Yeah, just reach across from Martin.
Can you give me that back there?
Thank you.
Do you want the other ones? Okay.
Olay. Olay.
Are you okay there?
Perfect. Thank you, Martin.
Seems a bit strange coming out of a hotel and going to a fast food place.
I know. But Martin wants to go to wants some fast food.
He likes this, yeah. Probably feels a bit safer, really.
And he had chicken and chips here the other night. And he ate it, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know.
So he likes it?
Yeah.
Oh well, sure, whatever he likes.
Yeah.
He stopped singing. He was singing Good-O there a minute ago.
Yeah.
You should put this. Not too far.
No,
sure it wasn't.
No.
It's only around the corner.
No.
Still cold, isn't it? Can I sit here?
Yeah, you can sit.
Thank you. That's okay. You hungry, Martin?
Yes. He's hungry.
As we waited for our food to arrive, a David Bowie song came on the sound system and Martin got very excited. I felt a great sense of admiration for John and Norma, not embarrassed but smiling at each other as they watched their son Martin standing in the middle of a packed Supermax singing and dancing at his own reflection in the window.
Yeah.
You're holding hands. Do you have to hold his hand, John? Yeah.
Well, I think he feels more secure, really.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. It's good, though, isn't it, that you can hold his hand?
Oh, yeah.
It's safe. Food good, Martin?
Are you full up now, Martin?
Yes. Yeah.
You enjoy that?
Yes.
Is it nice?
Yes.
You ready for some more music? More music.
More music tonight.
Robert Mosell is the headlining act in this year's festival and Martin is his number one fan. On returning from Supermax, Martin spots the Mosell tour bus parked at the back of the hotel and insists on taking a look.
Yeah. How'd you get out to it?
Should we have to help you sort it?
Just go out this door here. Do you want to go out? Where's the van, Martin? Look around here. The authentic voice of country, Robert Mosell, and the Country Kings on tour. Martin's walking all around the van. That's it. He recognises it, doesn't he? He's smiling. He's standing in front of the truck, smiling his head off. What's he doing, John?
He's really excited now because he's looking forward to his big night tonight with Robert.
There's the truck. There's no denying it. He's here. That's what's happening, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're all excited, really.
He's dancing in front of the van. Taking some photographs. So explain to me the photographs. What do you do then when you go home?
Well, he has lots of photographs. So it's a kind of a memory thing, I suppose, that he's good memories of being in these places where all his good music is.
Mm-hmm.
Because his whole life is wrapped up in music, really. So,
So everywhere you go, you have to. He has to get his picture taken in front of the truck, the tour truck.
Yeah, because we normally, and get photographs of the with the band as well inside.
Oh, right.
So we have a whole lot of photographs.
You have a lot to do, don't you? And photographs with the band, and then when he goes home to Manchester, he pulls them out.
You have to be. You all have to be.
What that?
To a certain size, and I have to make sure they come out right, and they have to be good.
Good quality.
You might need one for his pile, because he has piles of them, and one in a little frame.
Really?
Yeah, he likes one in his bedroom.
The lady wants them in the bedroom. Martin, are we going to take your photograph now beside Robert's? Watch the car coming in behind us.
He is so excited, smiling and grinning. Okay, going over for the picture. Oh, he's posing, look. Oh. What do you make of that, Norma? Huh?
No, yeah. Oh, he's really chuffed a bit.
He's absolutely. He stopped stemming and swinging and everything.
I know,
he's posing for the camera.
Yeah.
So these pictures are really important to him.
Oh, they are, yeah. Very important, yeah.
Yeah, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because he's completely still. He's never still. And when John says smile, he stops moving.
Yeah.
So we are.
Say that again, John, close up.
Because we're doing one close up. Smile.
Say cheese, Martin. Cheese.
Say cheese.
Yeah!
Smiley face.
He'll remember me now. I'm in one of the shots with the mic. That's great. Do you want to take some more?
Martin.
Say cheese, Martin.
Say cheese.
Yes. Cheese. Eben have a new man. Smile. Man.
Smile. Brilliant.
It's a lovely big van, Martin.
Half a name, a Nina, nay. But them moving cow.
Something about a moving cow. Wasn't it? Is that?
Any ray, anything in there?
Say you love me. Say you love me.
Any ray, anything in there?
He's having so much fun, isn't he? More pictures.
You're happy now, Martin.
All done.
Got some fragmented.
My goodness, I can't imagine what he's going to be like tonight. If he's like that when he just sees the fan.
Yeah,
what is he like when he sees Robert himself?
Yeah. Oh, he'll be.
He's grinning and smiling. Does he go crazy? Yeah, jumping and dancing.
Oh, yeah, he's really.
Goes for it.
He's really fired up.
This time, but
he'll be all definitely be excited.
Yeah,
all
fired up.
See, Robert is probably one of his favourites, really.
Yeah. So he's meeting his idol tonight, isn't he?
And he's letting quite a lot of Robert's songs as well.
The band!
He's letting a lot of his songs recently as well.
Banging. Brilliant. Will we go in? We're cold now. I went back to Stuart and Clarissa's house in Cork to spend more time with them and to ask Stuart about his personal goals and about the challenges that lie ahead for him.
Well, there's a whole stack of them. Losing weight is one.
You don't need to lose weight.
That's the worst one.
You don't.
To be outside the house every day. For instance, this month, I've left the house 7 times.
Okay.
But in February, I left the house 3 times.
Wow. In a whole month?
So I'm supposed to go out every day. That's on my action plan. And
This is with Yvonne?
Yeah.
Yeah. And go out means go for a walk, go around the corner?
Anything at all. But the 3 times I went out were once to see Yvonne, once to see the counsellor, and once to give a lecture. So it was cheating.
There was
because
a purpose.
I had to be there. I need a purpose to go out. I can't go out for a walk.
You couldn't just go out for a walk?
I like somebody to go with me. So,
because I was at the Big As I Am conference.
I would have liked to have gone, but
and we were emailing, and I offered to accompany you. You know, I said to Stuart, "I'll be there," because you had emailed back, and I knew you really wanted to go. I had a feeling you really would have loved to have been there. And after attending, I could see why. You know, it was fantastic. But I said, "Well, look, I'll be there if that makes any difference." But of course not. It wouldn't have made any difference. But if you're going to go next year with Carissa.
Yeah. If she takes me up.
Well, you have to tell me. If you had told me that was
scheduled,
I would have taken the time off.
She's a busy lady.
Chris has just changed jobs and been to some backwater of England for a warehouse and off to Atlanta, Georgia.
Working lady. So you wouldn't, I mean, there's just no way you would have been able to go to Dublin at all from Cork, no way, to attend that conference.
I have done things like that, but very, very infrequently.
Is the stress just far too much, the anxiety, the worrying?
It's mostly manipulating somebody into thinking that we're going together rather than that they're minding me.
All these little tactics he has, all these little devices,
I got away with it for years without even knowing that I had never been to a restaurant on my own.
But you must have known.
No, I didn't know.
Really? Yeah.
But it's only after I was diagnosed I realised that there are all these times when I'd go and buy a sandwich from the newsagent and eat on a bench outside rather than sitting in a restaurant. And I've done that all my life.
But you never even thought to yourself, why don't I ever go into the restaurant?
It doesn't occur to me.
Yeah. When you're sitting in the rain, Stuart, with the umbrella over you eating your sandwich,
it never occurred to me.
what do you make of that? Is it because, well, that's what you just want to do?
I suppose if you've always done it, you don't think it's odd.
Yeah, yeah.
Last summer,
I'd been out to restaurants, to cafes with the key worker over and over, practicing this, ordering food and sitting down and
what's that like?
Eating in a public place. If I'm with somebody, it's fine.
Yeah. Because they do all the
But then last summer, I went to Cafe Carmel in the airport and ordered a coffee all by myself. And I had a coffee in a public space. And it was the first time ever in my life.
At 52?
At 52, yes.
So what did that feel like?
I didn't enjoy it. But it was a big milestone.
But you did it.
To be able to do it. And now, if I travel, I know I could do it again.
So funny. And what would have happened, Stuart, if some random or some person that you'd never met before, if something happened, if somebody came up to you and said something, was trying to sell you something or chat to you?
That's the fear, that what is going to happen?
What do you think's going to happen?
The earth might open up and, I don't know, demons.
World would end, obviously.
We'll fly down.
It's catastrophic stuff.
It's just the thought of what might happen is so awful.
But do you play out little scenarios in your head? Do you actually imagine awful things happening?
I do, yes.
Mm, like what?
Well, like I say, demons coming out of the sky and the earth opening up.
It's as bad as that, yeah?
Yeah, and strangers coming and sitting beside me with a knife and...
Do you really?
Yeah, I do.
But these aren't comedic images. These are serious.
Oh, they are serious. Yeah, they prevent me going out.
Mm.
And when you say that to a psychiatrist, they're immediately thinking, "Is this a delusional thought?" But it's just I think the anxiety of not being able to predict social situations means that your mind, which is very good at making patterns, thinks up a good reason why you might be frightened, and makes those pictures.
So are you going to try? You did it twice. You went out for coffee by yourself twice so far. You want to do it again?
I actually haven't been anywhere by public transport since then. But
I was told that Stuart had an extremely strong work ethic, so I was eager to know how far that went.
So for the last 4 years, you've just been doing personal projects?
Trying to fit more in.
Mm.
Because my biggest problem is the regulation, that I get into something and then I just do... that thing.
Mm. Yeah, you just get stuck into something.
I have to learn to regulate, otherwise it's burnout.
Yeah, and all-consuming.
Yes.
Everything else falls by the way. Yeah.
Because 20 hours spent reading on the web
can
be quite...
that's draining.
It is draining.
Isn't
it? And I don't notice that I'm drained until I find I haven't been to the loo and I haven't eaten. And
would you really do that? Would you be so absorbed that
could
sit there for hours and hours? And forget about eating.
Oh, if Chris and Thalia and Melina are away, I could spend longer than a day doing the one thing.
Really?
If nobody comes in to disturb me.
And describe that. I mean, what is that really like? Is that you just sitting in front of your computer and working?
Well, I call it being in the zone. That you can get into this zone and just stay there, and it's so comforting. And
what's comforting about it? Do you know? Can you express it?
The predictability. At the moment, I'm scanning slides.
Mm.
So this is a very dull thing, but each one has to be done properly.
Mm.
They've got to be straight. They've got to be scanned to the right colour depth and everything.
Now, just explain, these are slides of?
35mm slides that my parents left when they died.
Oh, so they're family slides.
I scanned all the print pictures, which was quite easy.
Yeah.
And now I'm scanning the slides, which is more complicated.
But that must be enjoyable, no?
It is enjoyable. It's fabulous to see these things. They're locked away in a drawer and we haven't seen them for years. And then suddenly they're all on a computer and indexed. And we know.
Is it a big trip down memory lane as well?
Yes,
must be.
It is.
After hearing Stuart talk about his family photos, I was dying to have a look.
So whose house was this?
That's my mother.
Really?
So, with her, she was very keen on flowers, on lentil flowers. Very, very good at...
Did she live to be a good age?
To 79?
No, 80.
80. Do you remember her fondly? How was your relationship with the Stuart's mum?
Oh, I was very, very fond of Stuart's parents.
Mm-hmm. What about your relationship with your parents, Stuart?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. So she would have been alive when you were diagnosed with autism. Did she understand that at all, or did you talk to her about it?
She rejected it.
Yeah.
But my father had recalled all of these things that I did as a child that fitted very well with what the psychologist was saying. So my father said yes, certainly. But not to the same degree as my nephew.
Yeah, but sure, everybody is different anyway. Oh,
no two people are the same.
You share a lot of the traits with your father anyway.
Yes.
Do you think your father might have been a little bit autistic?
Oh, I think so, yes. Yes, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind.
Right. Was that ever discussed between the two of you while he was alive?
No, I don't think so.
Not really, no.
Why not? There's probably no point. Too old.
I think he was in his 70s. It wouldn't have been necessarily useful.
Makes no difference.
Not at all, no.
And he died very suddenly.
Yes, I mean, he was lucky. He was incredibly fit, and he died 30 feet up a steep bank cutting trees for his fire.
Oh, heart attack?
A heart attack, and he died without even knowing he was ill, so I think that's the
Was he just found
best way to go.
Lying?
No, he was with somebody. So they actually had to call an air sea rescue because there was no way of getting his body down 30 feet of the
Where
bank.
Where was this, George?
In Cornwall.
Oh, and he
so
was
the Coast Guard was nearby.
He was 82.
82?
Yeah, he was 82, and cutting trees. And you think, we'd all love to be doing that kind of active stuff right to the end.
It's just absolutely brilliant.
You know, when you see farmers who have died on the farm because they've been trampled by a cow, and I think I'd love to be still active, to be old enough to be trampled by a cow.
You see, a robust sense of humour again.
Sort of getting that slowly but surely.
I prefer that to being ill.
I'd love to be old enough to be able to be trampled by a cow. That's how I'd like to go. It was like, what was that very funny line you said last night when we were chatting? You said about the hospital stays, you were saying this.
Oh, it was lovely.
You loved the rigor.
Yeah. The rigor, yes.
I wrote it. What did you say last night? Do you remember?
The rigor was lovely.
Of hospitals, of being institutionalised short term. You loved the rigor of it. Yes. You actually said there's something quite lovely about the rigor of hospital stays.
Well, there is, definitely. And the humour inside psychiatric hospitals is fabulous.
Is it? Yeah.
People who have depression and schizophrenia, they're so fabulously funny. We're discussing suicide. There were a number of people who had attempted to kill themselves or to die, and one of them had taken a large number of tablets, and whilst he was taking them he was idly reading the packaging and discovered they were out of date. That's just a hilarious conversation to have.
So was he thinking they mightn't work?
No, he was thinking they might hurt him.
Okay.
It was just the thought process of having that discussion with somebody where he's saying, I took
that is funny.
They were out of date. He was telling it as a joke.
What else? What other memories do you have of hospitals?
Oh, the anarchy. And the anarchy towards staff was very funny.
Really?
Yeah.
So you quite enjoyed it? A couple of
times?
Yeah. How many times were you in hospital?
Five in total.
Five times?
Two of them were very short.
Over a period
of? 8 years.
And this was all because of misdiagnosis and wrong medication. And explain how all that happened.
I think the biggest thing is emotion recognition is used for diagnosis. If people aren't showing affect, if they're not showing emotions, then there must be something wrong with them, like depression or
You were depressed.
I was depressed.
Very
no
clearly.
Doubt that I was depressed. But I think the two things, they work together to make it look like none of the medication for depression is working. And what looks like normal for me is not what looked like normal in the eyes of the psychiatrists who are treating me. So they kept saying, you're not getting any better.
So the normal traits of autism that you're exhibiting all through your life were being misdiagnosed.
And if somebody's testing you by trying to make you angry or trying to make you remember something sad, and assuming you'd show a sad expression because you're recalling something sad, and you sit there telling them this incredibly traumatic story with a big smile on your face because somebody's paying attention to you, it's not appropriate emotion. And inappropriate emotion is, I think, the biggest indicator of mental ill health.
Yeah.
So then they're trying to treat something that they see as mental ill health, and it's actually just, it's the way I am.
Yeah, yeah.
I would tell a traumatic story and not have the right expression on.
But this wasn't getting picked up for years and years and years by the medical profession at all.
Yeah.
But also you're incredibly articulate. And I think that masked a lot of the underlying reasons to the professionals. Because they have somebody who's very articulate, can communicate extremely well. Sure, you can possibly be autistic. It's not in the top things that they think, because they probably think that lack of communication or inability to communicate is one of the top things, and it's not necessarily. It's something that's diagnosed in children and not in adults. The adult diagnosis has started relatively recently.
So, Stuart, you were what age when you were diagnosed with autism?
45.
45, yeah, so very late.
It is, yes. I think my life would have been different, but I don't know if it would have been better. People ask that a lot. Like if they have a teenager who's managed to get through national school and into secondary school and they haven't been diagnosed yet, should you go and get them diagnosed or should you not?
Just leave it be.
And I don't know the right answer. It's a very hard decision to make, because if you have the diagnosis, people change their conceptions of what you're capable of.
But for you, though, the diagnosis was it was a great thing, wasn't it, for you as a family, for you personally?
For me, it made a huge difference, because the medication ended. I was much, much happier after the medication finished.
The wrong medication.
And not having to be in continuous day hospital and follow-up.
So life completely changed at 45. Explain how.
That's a very difficult question.
Is it?
Yes.
Well, no medication.
No medication.
You were relieved with the diagnosis, you told me. Yeah, it was a huge relief, wasn't it?
Oh, a massive relief, yes.
So there's certainly a big burden off you, isn't there?
And I think, I mean, I describe it as a light bulb moment, that suddenly things which didn't make sense, make sense.
Carissa, what did the diagnosis mean for you?
I hadn't considered it, but it actually made quite good sense. It just put a framework around the behaviour. So, you know, sometimes when Stuart would get to say, "No, I don't want to go out," and I'd get to say, "Never go out anyway," I'd get grumpy about it, or would leave parties early because he'd look, I really can't stay here any longer, and I thought, oh, somebody upset him. But it's knowing why that reaction was there makes a huge difference. And knowing that, even simple things, that if I do my hair and come back from the hairdresser, I shouldn't expect anybody in the house to notice it. So I'll walk in and say, "I've been to the hairdresser, my hair looks nice. You have to tell me that my hair looks nice." "Your hair looks great." "Yes."
And with Stuart, would you have not have even noticed, not at all, that the hair was done, that Chris had been to the hairdresser?
I might too, I don't know. Not really.
No, you wouldn't.
Wish you had to
I
tell
certainly
you.
I wouldn't care.
But it's knowing what to expect and what not to expect, and not to expect that some things would happen, and not to treat that as a personal thing. So it's a lot of simple things like that can be, on a day-to-day basis, if you think that somebody is ignoring you or is snubbing you, can get a bit annoying.
It could have turned into friction, couldn't it, and a bad relationship. The two of you obviously have an absolutely fantastic relationship.
Well, it didn't particularly, because it's kind of...
Because you said to me before that you just really had Stuart Penn as being a little bit quirky.
Yeah.
That's the way he was, that's the way he is.
Yeah.
Until it all went sort of a bit belly up with a job, didn't it, Stuart? When everything was plodding along. Okay, and you were dealing with the quirkiness, the two of you, and the little routines and getting stuck in things. But then you were bullied very badly in work, weren't you?
Yeah, I had a job where I don't know what the problem was. But I spent so long trying to think through why things went the way they did, but I just felt that I was being picked on every day. And 4 years of that, I became very depressed.
And then you explained that this was like a trigger.
I think it's not necessarily that person or that environment, that event. It could have been something else would have triggered it. I think the sensitivity is there to predisposition to being depressed or anxious is there for all people with autism.
But you can be more depression, of a target of bullying as
Depression is very, very common in autistic people.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's biological. I think that's social, that life is hard. When you're trying to make up for an impairment in social judgment and emotional reciprocity, where you've got to think what somebody is feeling rather than just having it as, I don't know, is it just there as some kind of instinct for other people? Yeah. And I don't have that, so I have to think through it and get it wrong.
Yeah, a lot of autistic people find it, who've been working, find it difficult in their 40s. Mm. It's a coming of age thing almost. It's a things suddenly get so so being, you know, unhappy at work and being picked on at that age, you know, he'd probably have managed it when he was 20. Mm. Because at 20 you can say, oh, you can get lost and I'll walk off and do find something else. It's in your mid 40s, it's a bit harder to do that, or you feel it's a bit harder to do that. But it was kind of a whole load of things. So it was a serious enough event in itself, but it was also at a time that it was very distractive.
Mm. Well, everything really fell apart for you, Stuart, didn't it?
It did, yes.
And you, Chris, everything fell apart as a family.
Oh, it was very hard. It was a very hard few years, yeah.
Mm.
It's very difficult to live with somebody who's very profoundly depressed and not getting better and not finding a way with treatment and so on that that makes things better.
Yeah.
So it was hard work.
But it did come to a point, didn't it, where you had enough and you went into a particular doctor and you had strong words, fierce words.
Very strong words, and he was actually the first one who listened properly.
Okay.
And the guy had done nothing wrong, you know. Mm. He just happened to be there. He happened to be the doctor who was looking after Stuart at the time. I'd never seen him before, but I had a go about all the things that happened before, and there was some very inappropriate treatment that broke protocols. So I said that if a particular medic even went near Stuart, I would be making a formal complaint to the medical council. So I don't know if that made a difference. I was very
angry. There was actually something vindictive there, where one of the psychiatrists had written NCNA on the front of the folder. And of course, as a patient, you have no idea what that means, but it means non-compliant, non-attender.
Right, okay.
And obviously a psychiatrist reading that, seeing a new patient for the first time, will say, well, doesn't take the medication, doesn't turn up.
Mm. It was actually incorrect.
And it was incorrect, and it was just something, I'd had an argument with a psychiatrist, and he'd just written this on the front.
So how did you find out what the letters meant?
He told Chrissa, because Chrissa went in and said, what are you doing to my husband? And he said, well, he's a non-compliant non-attender. And she's like, when?
And you knew this was incorrect?
Completely incorrect, because Stuart has never not attended anything. If he says he'll be somewhere, it's, you know, there has to be very major floods and stuff to keep him away. He's very rigorous at doing stuff.
Mm. And how long through the process are we now at this stage, in years, in terms?
That's probably about a year before you were diagnosed, isn't it?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
About 8 years of bouncing
eight
around.
Yeah. Years of different medications, talking, trying to figure. And of course, George, where are you along those 8 years, up and down, at home, in hospitals?
Yeah, and trying to get some kind of job, and not lasting very long in any job.
Yeah, that's very difficult, isn't it?
And nobody wants to employ mentally ill people. Mm. It's very hard. I mean, even having the history of it, it's hard to get a job.
Mm. I mean, these were really bad times for you guys, weren't they?
Yeah.
And the two girls too, the children, you know, trying to bring the children up as well and figure it all out. And then it all changed one day when a doctor suggested what to you, Stuart?
Yes, this was Daniel Flynn. And I thought the way he handled it was incredibly sensitive, where he didn't say, I think you've got autism spectrum disorder. He said, have you heard about the autism spectrum? And said, go and look at this website, the National Autistic Society in the UK. Read their introductory guides there, and then come back next week and tell me what you think about it.
Yeah. Was that the first time that autism had ever been mentioned to you or that you had thought about it?
It was the first time it was mentioned, but the first time I thought of it was a few years before that, where I saw a character on TV who I thought was doing the same kinds of things as I do, who was described as having Asperger's syndrome. I watched the plot of the movie and I thought, why is everyone complaining about that guy?
Because he's totally normal. He's fine. He's absolutely perfect. He's like
he's
me.
Grand. He's
grand. Don't worry, we all like that.
No, we're not.
So you went home and did you just Google autism spectrum disorder?
I went to the NAS website and I read their guides to what autism is. And they have a section on autism in adults and the autism spectrum, that it's not... you know, all people aren't alike, but it has a certain set of traits, and I think, yes, I have those traits.
It was a fantastic piece of lateral thinking on his part, though.
It was,
he really, he saved your life, he really did.
The Moon is an Orange Triangle 3 is a Real Films production and was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.